This is a little note from Goblin Hood in front of the reading, which is about to follow. This particular story or essay or whatever it is pretty much coincides with the beginning of the triptych, Sweet Sodom Apocalypso, and in fact it's talking about the triptych. The dream it's talking about was about the triptych, so this is kind of a special deal, and I'm including this little foreword on my own. With most of Biotti's stuff, this is virtually unpublished. It's never even been read by anybody else. As with most of Biotti's stuff, there's a lot of, like, italics that are signified by certain words being underlined. The best I can do with these is to simply stress the word in various ways, which can be confused sometimes with quotation marks. There's at least one place in here where I'll probably say quote unquote, but usually I don't bother with that. I just, again, stress the word in some way. Since most of these tapes I'm making are so that Biotti can listen to them while he's painting on the triptych, this one seems particularly appropriate. It was virtually a sort of epic statement to himself, to the effect that the triptych is worth doing, I guess, or something like that. Anyway, I'm just going to read it like all the rest. It may seem strange that it's written by Biotti and it's basically a sort of a confessional in his own first-person words. It's me, Goblin Hood, reading it. At some point I'll be talking about myself in the course of this. That's not very unusual either. It's just that Biotti's more comfortable with Goblin Hood reading the stuff, so let's just leave it at that. If I have anything else to say along these lines, I'll say it at the end. The manuscript was dated February 26, 1998, circa 1:11 p.m., which I guess was when he began writing it. And here it doesn't say when the manuscript was finished, but I happen to remember, since this was basically just a little over a year ago, that this was probably the second thing of this sort that he did with a dream in that period. It was probably all written at once, and I'm talking about, like, okay, he got up and started writing it at 1:11 p.m. on February 26. He probably finished it sometime early the next morning or whatever. The manuscript, the typescript here is 20 pages and about a third of a page long, a quarter of a page long. So you can see from that it was quite an endeavor, but this was the way Biotti worked at the time. He would get up, and since he was afraid of, like, some subsequent dream pushing it out of his mind, he'd try to write the whole thing down at once, including all the preparatory material, which in this case is most of the document. But it's an important document. It explains that as it goes along. The typescript was started at March 23rd, 1998, circa 4:18 p.m., and it was finished May 27th, 1998, circa 10 p.m., so it took a lot longer to type than it did to write, obviously. But during that time, while he was typing, and he was also working on the triptych, the early stages of it. And so the only thing I can add is that the events in the dream haven't taken place so far, but the kind of frantic nature of it is pretty much, you know, has been in place all along. So I'm going to shut up now as far as, like, you know, this goblinhood preface, and just go on to the reading. Steel Bob and Monstrella, A Dream of Inconvenience, by James Beatty. Author's note: as best I can figure out, the name Steel Bob may have been subconsciously derived from a science fiction novel called Earthblood, 1966, by Keith Laumer and Roselle George Brown. I read this most recently about 7 months ago, but I used to read it a lot when I was in high school. It contains alien or quasi-alien characters named Iron Robert and Stella Rare, both galactic circus performers. And so one might suppose the name Monstrella to have originated there too. For reasons of my own, I'm going to let that impression stand at this point. 1. The paintings were vile. There was never any question about that. It may well even be that the paintings were irredeemably odious, as far as that goes. I'm not really up on these matters, so I couldn't really say. But this you must understand, the three connected paintings, even in their early stages, were, at least unquestionably, vile, even to my jaundiced eyes. It was as if there'd been an empty space in the universe. They say that nature abhors a vacuum, and I decided to fill it with these paintings, and then everybody in nature, even me, had begun to seriously miss that good old vacuum. So why were such god-awful paintings permitted to exist? Oh, they weren't just permitted to exist, friends and neighbors. I'd been going to a great deal of trouble to make the paintings exist, and I meant to go on. This is all kind of hard to explain out here, but in the dream it needed no explanation, any more than I truly need to explain what I'm doing to myself while I'm doing it. And you can take that ambiguity any way you like. Anyway, here's the condensed version of what's happening here. I began painting in 1969, having taught myself to paint out of a book on how to paint nudes, one of those Walter Foster jobs. And despite intermittent and desultory schooling after that, my general modus operandi would evermore continue to involve self-taught research and development. Over the years, my artistic experiments gradually began to yield the kind of results that I was looking for. All well and good so far. A typical success story, right? Swell. But here's an early infusion of influence that might explain a lot. In 1971, I stumbled upon a story by H.P. Lovecraft, which would haunt the back of my mind from then on. The story, Pickman's Model, was about an artist in Boston who painted ghouls. He was a vile artist at best, but it turned out that he had a secret studio tucked away in the slums across town where he could be downright odious, if not monstrous, in his painterly endeavors. This secret studio was full of paintings that were a bit stronger than Pickman could manage at home. I think you'd enjoy the pictures, for as I said, I've let myself go a bit there. As Pickman himself put it, speaking to his only fan. At the time of reading this, I was an extremely repressed thinker, with an oddly puritanical streak where sex was concerned. Odd, in view of the so-called sexual liberation that had been so much a part of the tumultuous 1960s, which were my primary artistic spawning ground. I couldn't even discuss sex scientifically, clinically that is, without shame, confusion, and dissembling. Odder still, I was divided enough in spirit to somehow feel guilty about that shame as well. But I wasn't exactly a virgin, if you're wondering. In 1971, I wasn't yet 21 years old, but I'd already had sexual relations with at least 7 different women, a remarkable track record for someone as shy, inept, and repressed as I basically was, and still am. Most of these encounters were mere 1 or 2 night stands, though at least 2 of them involved long-lasting relationships with lots of recurrent sex. Sadly, I can't say that any of these interactions were in any way emotionally successful for either party involved. And speaking through hindsight, I can add that none of them were really successful sexually either. At least, not from my point of view in terms of what I now know my orientation to be. The one time I came close to that, during the longest relationship of the bunch, the woman and I discontinued the act almost immediately due to mutual shame, confusion, and embarrassment, and, through hindsight, because we were trying to use the wrong sort of lubricant, if that rings any bells. Somehow, cold cream just doesn't get it, you know? So in that odd sense, I still was exactly a virgin, and would remain so despite numerous further encounters for some time to come. Time filled with endless, furtive self-examination and self-analysis on the subject. Just be glad you're getting the condensed version of things here. Meanwhile, I haven't wandered far from the dream that I've been talking about. Steel Bob and Monstrella, remember? It's just that my artistic background in the dream was exactly the same as my background out here in real life. So to understand the dream, you have to try and understand all this. Anyway, there I was, back in 1971, something of a half-assed virgin, teaching myself to paint, reading Pickman's model, and sort of getting religion in the process. In some indefinable way, Lovecraft's ghoulish artist, Richard Upton Pickman, became my secret role model. This was either in spite of my repressed psyche, or who knows, perhaps actually because of it. How I longed to paint vile, monstrous pictures that I could then turn around and top with something a bit stronger, as Pickman had been wont to put it. And the idea of doing all this in a secret studio was truly seductive and compelling, and would stay with me for a long, long time, to the present date, as a matter of fact. Meanwhile, for the sake of completion, I should mention another vague but telling influence here, a cinematic one. I had begun to be haunted by the futuristic decor of Stanley Kubrick's 1971 dystopian masterpiece, A Clockwork Orange. The perverse and uninhibited artwork in the film's background bespoke a future aestheticism that I somehow aspired, for whatever twisted reasons, to become a part of. Anyway, up until reading Pickman's model, my paintings had consisted of a few tepid nudes, mostly from life drawing classes. Imaginary landscapes, portraits, imaginary and otherwise, and a few wholly imaginary scenes involving monsters, usually a form of introspective self-portraiture, one way or another. Under Pickman's influence, I now stepped up the depiction of monsters. Perhaps this phenomenon was related to Goya's Sleep of Reason, among other things. It was also around this time that I began using overtly sexual images from magazines and the like as reference material for my figure studies. What the hell? Pickman used photographs in his work all the time. These sexual images were from what we would now regard as soft core pornographic sources. That meant a lack of visible prurience, i.e., no erect penises, as well as a total lack of any kind of penetration. But these images could get pretty suggestive for all that. Probably my best painting based on this stuff was a largish canvas depicting a weird, flaccid orgy of sorts, involving, if I remember correctly, three women and a man. He was naked. The women wore only garter belts and stockings. They formed a sort of overall pyramidal group over the recumbent male. At least two of the women, if not all three, were prominently displaying their voluptuous asses to the reader, to the viewer. I didn't then know just why I found this view so fascinating. Meanwhile, far from employing any secrecy, I actually exhibited this painting in a student art show at the time. For better or worse, none of these paintings have survived. My next serious influence, relevant here, was that 1960s phenomenon known generically as underground comics. These graphic narratives partook of the rebelliousness of that pre-Watergate era and were true countercultural artifacts. They were to almost divert me away from painting entirely and into black and white drawing, like most of the comics. And they profoundly influenced what I did paint when I eventually started up again. Among other things, these comics, by various artists, featured erect penises galore, not to mention every kind of penetration that could be imagined, and then some. In that sense, they resembled the 8-page Tijuana Bibles of an earlier era, the kind men like. But in almost every other aspect, the underground comics were virtually sui generis. I've already mentioned the notion of counterculture rebellion. The comics were steeped in this, whether they individually admitted it or not. Sometimes they seemed not to want to. But their prevalent socio-political content often made the comics genre as a whole seem like one big throbbing deformed, erect penis attempting to forcibly penetrate every collective psychic orifice possessed by society for society's own good. Or so I saw it at the time. You have to remember how corrupt American society seemed to the societal outsider back then. The Vietnam War was still going strong, much to the disgust of many, while the sinister revelations of Watergate were only just beginning. A sense of righteous treason was in the air, which I would ultimately come to characterize as a mythical drug called treasonol, permeating certain elements of American culture. And the underground comics, for all their excesses, seemed to capture that quasi-revolutionary sense perfectly, as well as representing an innovative visual arts movement all their own. And meanwhile, another cinematic influence comes into play right through here, albeit an extremely convoluted one for me. This was Bernardo Bertolucci's 1972 quasi-erotic masterpiece, Last Tango in Paris, the film that put sodomy on the map in a way that Deliverance, for instance, never could. Though I've finally seen this flick on video only very recently. At the time, I knew of it only by rumor and reputation. Certain scenes, such as the ones involving butter and fingernail scissors, quickly became downright legendary in some circles and elevated Marlon Brando to the almost mythical status of depraved sexual icon, lauded and lionized by discerning gutter snipes everywhere. Anyway, by the summer of 1973, I'd found my way to San Francisco, high citadel of the underground comics, and actually spent a little time hanging out with a couple of the top underground cartoonists who were discussing, among other things, Last Tango in Paris, and arguing about the differences between sodomy and sadism, and between those per se and rape. Hence, I linked the film and the comics in my mind. In any case, the echoes of Brando's bravura performance would again haunt the back of my consciousness for years to come, seeming in some berserk sense like something to be lived up to. Perhaps in connection with all this last, or perhaps not, but for whatever it's worth, the underground comics also regularly featured unimaginably graphic depictions of grotesque and seemingly psychotic violence, sometimes in conjunction with perverse sex of one kind or another. As I recall, this was my first direct intimation that sex and violence had, or could have, anything to do with each other. I can't describe just how closed and dissociative and downright occlusive my mind was in some areas, even about things that experience itself should have schooled me to. At any rate, I'd never read anything by de Sade, for example, and only dimly knew who he was. This aspect of the comics led me to a still ongoing study of the relationship between sex and violence carried out in my work. If it matters, I've long since outgrown the notion that sex and violence should ever be the same thing, except between consenting adults. I don't regard rape as sex, for instance. I regard it as criminal violence, second only to outright torture, mutilation, and murder. Back to the underground comics. It goes without saying, given our particular puritanical society, that the underground comics were rigorously suppressed at the time, and still are to some extent. This, of course, only added to their cutting-edge status in my own overheated view. The comics were already spot on to an admirer of Hickman's artistic philosophy. Society's condemnation was scarcely needed to further apotheosize the comics and their approach. It also goes without saying, again, given our peculiarly schizoid society, that the comics were nevertheless always available to some extent and were rigorously defended in some quarters and still are to this day, none of which was ever lost on me, too. And meanwhile, I am still talking about the long-heralded Steel Bob and Monstrella dream, but those two characters are virtually decades in the future from where my discussion is at right now. And in the meantime, don't get your expectations up too high, or you'll only be disappointed. Steel Bob and Monstrella was an interesting enough little dream, but its real value was to get me writing about this esoteric and somewhat disreputable branch of my own art history, something which I've needed to do and have been meaning to do for quite a while. As for Steel Bob and Monstrella, their eventual brief antics will probably be seen as more absurdly amusing than anything else, though with dreams it's sometimes hard to know just how to take things. Anyhow, bear with me if you're interested enough. Aside from being relevant to the dream, this quasi-encyclopedic little dissertation is important in its own right, to this author at least. On the other hand, if you just can't hack all this preliminary tripe and twaddle, please feel free to just fast forward to the stupid hijinks of Steel Bob and Monstrella and just pretend you already know everything about everything, okay? Or, for that matter, you can just stop reading entirely right now. And while you're at it, you can just go fuck yourselves and, well, anyway. Late in 1973, I started painting again, back home in Columbus, Ohio, if it makes any difference. My first two major canvases, finished the next year, were entitled The Knife is the Color of Time and Home. The color scheme of these semi-epic paintings, and several which followed, was largely derived from Dayglow psychedelic art and from the Harry Hu school of painting out of Chicago. But in drawing terms, these two elaborate compositions were most strongly influenced by underground comics. For the record, certain other films of roughly this period or so also had a lot of influence, both visual and cerebral, on these early paintings. Chief among such films would be Fellini's Satyricon, Hodorowski's El Topo, Ken Russell's The Devils, Frank Zappa's 200 Motels, and, possibly in some ways, Roman Polanski's Macbeth. There were also various strong literary and even musical influences, not to mention artists from Michelangelo to Van Gogh, even to Germany's obscure Otto Muhl. Compositionally, however, one of my all-time strongest influences turns out to be old movie posters by the likes of Reynald Brown, particularly for historic spectacles like Spartacus and science fiction opuses like This Island Earth. Such posters usually attempted to convey the flavor and even most of the contents of the entire film in one sweeping dramatic montage, and having only one surface at a time to deal with, I found this technique useful for presenting information in a logical and comprehensive way. Ironically, it's said that Brown got so disgusted at having to do a poster for Lovecraft's The Dunwich Horror, evidently emblematic to Brown of Hollywood's moral and tasteful deterioration, that he quit doing posters entirely and wasted the rest of his career, in my opinion, doing tepid Western paintings instead. Pickman would have been sardonically amused, I'm sure. As for those two early paintings of mine, the drawings were wildly distorted in many ways and quasi-hallucinogenic, though even by the advent of home, things were getting ever more overtly representational. Speaking of films, by the way, another then-current film, The Exorcist, operated strongly on my attitude toward the paintings, especially The Knife is the Color of Time. Again, I didn't actually see the flick until much later, but rumors of it, coupled with a primitivistic belief in art as sympathetic magic, invested this painting with an exorcismic quality in my mind that had something to do with Watergate and getting rid of Nixon. But let's not get any further into the realm of psychiatry here than we absolutely have to. But I might as well explain the term treasonal here too, since these pictures were obviously imbued lavishly with that concept. It too came from a film while watching a rerun of Failsafe on television with some friends during a scene where American soldiers were trying to help the Soviets shoot down a rogue American plane. I exclaimed that those guys must have been loaded to the gills on treasonal. Anyway, there was a lot of it going around back then, as I've already pointed out. At any rate, in addition to complicated, though obscure, political and sociological content, the paintings included elements of sex and graphic violence, though typically my treatment of sex was still pretty repressed. Tellingly, however, Home featured a quasi-hermaphroditic figure that would become a sort of dominant sub-motif much, much later. Meanwhile, I wasn't by any means the only one wallowing around in the throes of some ecstatic treasonal binge right through here, as already indicated. By the time I finished painting Home, we were getting into the post-Watergate era. By that point, even certain overground mainstream monthly four-color comic books were indulging themselves and their readers in more and more hip treason of the sort that I wound up regarding as apocalypso, a term that I coined back in those days. In passing, however, and to complete a thought, I may as well break in here and tell the following story, even though some of the dates are all mixed up in my deteriorating memory. Hope you weren't timing anything by these dates or anything like that. At least the dates on the paintings themselves are accurate. But according to my own mythology, the Watergate era ended when both the knife is the color of time and home were rejected by the 1974 Ohio State Fair art exhibit. Ironically, the knife is the color of time finally crashed that show almost two decades later when one of the judges was an old Harry Who affiliate. Meanwhile, the rejection in 1974 of two such swell paintings did more than just irritate me. It precipitated a minor psychotic episode of sorts, culminating in a feverish toothache. Nixon resigned the day that tooth was pulled. Earlier that year, or late the one before, I'd actually traveled to Washington with a friend while secretly suffering another kind of ailment involving an open but hidden wound. When we drove past the White House, all the powerful Watergate demons were supposedly sucked into my sick body through that wound to be drawn out months later in that rotting tooth. But why go on? As for the term apocalypso, like many foreign words and concepts, it's basically untranslatable. However important it's eventually become in my work. But it was probably directly inspired by something in a comic book by the late Jack Kirby. Kirby is sometimes said to have bridged the gap between underground and mainstream comic books with DC Comics titles like The Forever People and The New Gods. That last, in any case, featured a dystopian city called Armageddon on a dystopian world called Apocalypse, hence, I guess, the derivative term apocalypso. Anyway, I made the term up while listening to music by David Bowie, then and now my favorite musician, in spite of, or maybe because of, his alienated, otherworldly, androgynous stage persona. Back then, you had to find his albums in a section of the local stores labeled Fag Rock, and buying the music seemed to label you as well. But Bowie's earlier work, albums like Space Oddity, The Man Who Sold the World, Hunky Dory, Ziggy Stardust and the Spiders from Mars, Aladdin Sane, and most of all, the Orwellian Diamond Dogs, all had a sort of science fictional flavor to them, and this is what appealed to me. As a quasi-meditative prelude to my work, steeped in trees and all, I would sit around listening to these albums, literally stoned on such tunes as Cygnet Committee, All the Mad Men, Life on Mars, 5 Years, Drive-In Saturday, and Big Brother. And while listening, I'd read Marvel comics like Warlock, about an angst-ridden and messianic Cosmic Test Tube Superman, and Deathlok the Demolisher, about a berserk military cyborg running rampant and amok in a futuristic Orwellian version of New York. But my favorite was War of the Worlds, sometimes called Killraven, about a band of freedom fighters wandering the ruins of America following a future takeover by the now bacteria-immune Martians created by H.G. Wells. This series even featured an appearance by the missing Watergate tapes. Apocalypso, then, means, in general, a kind of stoically abandoned celebration of decadence and societal collapse, combined perhaps with a perhaps simple-minded blaming of everything wrong on corrupt authority. But then I was relatively young and callow back then. Haven't changed all that much, either. Anyway, the four-color superhero and science fictional comics were now influencing both my drawing and my coloring approach, though the content of my work was still what I considered underground. I was even living in a basement at this time. And it's important to remember this. However shamefaced I could be about my work, then and now, the disreputable and antisocial elements were actually a point of honor for me, then and now. After all, it was society that I was more or less rebelling against, and still is, more or less, I suppose. But not all of my work during this period was overtly sexual or violent. An example would be The Temptation of James Anthony, 1975, which marked both the advent of iridescent and metallic acrylic colors in my work, as well as some early experiments with silver and gold enamels, and also a further step in my increasing movement towards photorealism of one kind or another. Still, the overall trend in my work was to get as hysterically down and dirty as I could manage, and with good reason. By now I was looking at my work as a sort of art therapy, both for myself and for the world. Grandiose, but valid. In some ways, every artist is doing whatever his or her thing is for the world. Besides, I had an interesting specimen of Homo sapiens, myself, that I could test to destruction with impunity and without hurting anybody else, in a situation where, indeed, the proper study of man is man. Everything we can learn about ourselves is important, however obscure, and I felt and feel that creating a record of such investigations on my part must surely be worth more to the world than my merely leaving behind a lot of pretty but innocuous pictures. In any case, it's always made a neat little rationale for my going ahead and doing whatever I wanted to do, for better or for worse. And again, the ugliest parts of this were a point of honor in therapeutic terms. They were the things most needing to be said, and yet also the things most likely to be otherwise suppressed. One reason conventional psychotherapy has never really worked for me, aside from my basic distrust of everybody else on the planet, is that I still can't bring myself to talk openly about some matters, except to some disembodied and hypothetical future audience, as witness the paintings in this document here, if you can call this talking openly. Meanwhile, my own sexual self-awareness was growing apace, albeit slowly, grudgingly, and sporadically, my desultory encounters with various partners were still pretty conventional, but I was becoming increasingly aware of my true orientation. By oral and digital means, I was beginning to explore, whenever I could get away with it, the one aspect of female anatomy that aroused me the most, and in the interests of science, I was using digital forms of auto-eroticism to explore the self-same component of my own anatomy in my dedicated and uncompromising quest for self-knowledge. It was only natural that this more focused attitude would be reflected in the pornography that I furtively collected during this period. I won't bother arguing the redeeming social value of pornography, other than to point out that, in my case, my extremely visual orientation, coupled with my relative isolation and alienation from other people, made the stuff a real godsend for me if I was to have any kind of a regular sexual outlet at all. As for that focus, though still relatively soft core, these magazine images in my collection were becoming increasingly posterior, if you get my drift. And it was now that such photographic reference material, though always rendered freehand by me, once again found its way into my ever more Pickmanesque work in a painting called Snowballs in Hell, 1975, a painting that could arguably be said to have been about pornography, among other things. By the time of the painting Basket Case, 1976, things in the artwork were getting more overtly hardcore, though also tinged with a kind of vicious sadomasochistic violence that I guess I thought of as being brutally apocalypso. Between those two paintings, however, was the lost apocalypso painting. This was drawn one day in 1975, while heavily under the influence of Treasonal and of Bowie's Diamond Dogs album. Said epic drawing may well have been the most revealing of them all, and certainly the most overtly apocalypso. Unfortunately, this was drawn experimentally with felt tip pens instead of pencil, as per usual. When I attempted to fix the drawing with watery acrylic gloss medium, my routine method at that time, to be followed with endless glazes between images built up with modeling paste for a kind of dubious 3D effect, the entire felt tip drawing melted sadly away before my stupefied and disbelieving eyes, and that was that. I've seldom, if ever, had the energy to repeat some monumental task, and especially not after such a dismal failure as that. Major elements of this drawing, however, would reemerge decades later in my latest painting, A Bugbear in Sodom, circa 1998 or 99, I hope, which has determined the course of my present work. 3. By mid to late 1976, this dominant Pickmanesque vein in my work was beginning to seem vaguely scurrilous, even to me. My social awareness was evolving in a different, more subdued direction by now. in retrospect, I can see that this desire and eventual effort to humanize myself and come in from the cold was itself only another lengthy and ultimately futile experiment. With hindsight, it becomes sort of murkily clear that my attempts to stop being a scroungy gutter snipe artist and become more respectable were, for whatever obscure reasons, doomed from the start. But then, lost causes have always been a specialty of mine, I guess. Good thing, too, that I've long since developed a kind of talent for making virtue out of necessity. Who wants to be part of this crappy society anyway? All the grapes are much too sour. No, I'll stick with my... Oh, forget it. In any case, later that year, the overtly psychosexual and apocalypso element in my stuff culminated and ended in a painting entitled Beati's Inferno. Earlier that year, I'd built an 8x4 foot canvas, my largest yet, and was defiantly and kind of shamefacedly planning the biggest, baddest apocalypso painting of them all. It would be an incredibly violent epic with science fictional elements, a kind of pre-Star Wars space battle, somehow considered as a species of violent and global sex act, if that makes any sense. But things didn't go as planned. With subtle irony, it turned out that the most overtly military image then at my disposal was a photograph of my late mother wearing her uniform as a World War II Army nurse. Now, even a scraggly, apocalypsoid underground artist with monstrous aspirations needs to think twice about dumping an image of his sainted mother into the kind of gut-wrenching scene which I'd envisioned on that canvas. And, as I couldn't resist starting the drawing by testing my portrait skills on that image, I was subsequently forced to rethink all my plans. Somehow, the entire painting began to revolve around a near life-size portrait of her, and all the psychosexual elements fell by the wayside. The bloody wholesale slaughter, too, was replaced by an idea of personal combat, somehow embodying a philosophy of life. The result was Arenas, 1977, which started an entire new phase of my work. Its strongest single influence was a recent visit to the Salvador Dali Museum, then in Cleveland. This accounted for both the semi-classical preoccupations, still a favorite symbolist motif of mine to this day, as well as for the experiments in extra-dimensional drawing, a clumsy variation of on Dali's paranoiac critical technique, which has since evolved into the unbelievably convoluted form of compositional palimpsest, which I now call Martian pedimentation drawing, when I call it anything. But leaving out any kind of pornographic images didn't exactly render the painting bereft of nudity. That's where all that symbolist stuff came into play. My life drawing proclivities centered around the depiction, for symbolic purposes, of ancient Greek and Renaissance sculpture, some of which was pretty suggestive from a certain point of view. In addition, as if to prove that I just couldn't stand not throwing in some sex and violence, I included graphic and realistic renderings from photography of a spider eating a small fish and of a couple of tarantulas screwing. Still, it was all fairly sedate. And yet, right about this time, I was making a kind of fetish out of yet another favorite movie, possibly one of my top favorites of all time. The film was Kubrick's 2001, A Space Odyssey, which probably, as they say, needs no introduction here. Though horizontal rather than vertical, even as an object, the arena's painting subtly reminded me of the monolith in that film. I felt the painting was speeding up my evolution, causing me to transcend myself, pointing me in some bright new direction towards some bright new future. Given my atavistic streak of murky superstition then, especially where painting was concerned, it's probably no wonder that my work changed so much after this. Sounds like bullshit, you say, but then you probably don't know what I'm talking about. You probably don't even know what you're talking about. At any rate, arenas marked the start of a 20-year period during which I sought to subdue and sublimate the wilder and woolier elements in my work, perhaps hoping to reach a wider audience. Ironically, it's the nastier paintings that have since garnered me the most attention. But if there's a moral there, I don't have time for it now. Before that long interregnum, that long moratorium on cultural morbidity could truly begin, however, one more thing had to happen. The psychic venom meant to be spewed out in arenas had to go somewhere. You beginning to see how this stuff works? And it wound up going to the most appropriate spot imaginable. Beatty's Inferno, 1976, was painted on the same big rectangular piece of smeary masonite that the lost Apocalypso painting had once been attempted on. This time, things went by the book, and it worked out just great. Beatty's Inferno is a quasi-biblical painting. It turns out to be an extremely serious religious painting. I should know, I've since had to think up excuses for it to defend it from its many enemies, sometimes including myself. Though it marks my initial interpretational break with the quasi-fundamentalist version of Christianity that I was raised according to. No point in trying to explain what my religion is like now, by now. I'd rather refer back to 2001, A Space Odyssey again and mention that I think 1976 saw the launching of a Mars probe that has since become important both in my work and my religion. Bullshit, you say? Well, speaking of bullshit, try this on for size. One reason hysterical Christians probably get offended by Beatty's Inferno is that it propounds a more merciful God than the one they like to run around believing in. Odd that I would do that, and in my most vicious mood, too. But lots of things are odd. As it happens, Beatty's Inferno is also the site of my first explicitly sexual self-portrait, at least in terms of what I've been discussing here. This comprises part of a monstrous figure group, actually composed of monsters, representing the whore and the beast of Babylon, as well as the sins of Sodom and Gomorrah. I may have been taking dreadful liberties with the Bible, among other things, but at least I was finally spot on with that Sodom aspect in terms of sexual self-awareness. Best of all, from a therapeutic standpoint, the entire painted hellscape needed, by definition, to be vile, odious, and, if possible, monstrous, in order to be doing its job, the job of scaring people away from hell. It was all that and more. It was everything a Pickman wannabe could desire. It seemed pretty definitive at the time. Some 20 productive years passed. And throughout all those years, every time I started working on a large canvas, I was sorely tempted to include pornographic images of frank enormity, particularly after years of abstinence, both in this and otherwise. The way Michelangelo included all those gratuitous and erotic-looking nude athletes in his ceiling for the Sistine Chapel, but I always backed down, feeling vaguely virtuous about it, though certain ritualized forms of violence often found their way into the stuff. During this 20-year hiatus, I attempted only one large, unsublimated, apocalypso-type painting on gessoed burlap, which didn't survive. Beyond that, I was reduced to a few tawdry and furtive little acrylic sketches that examined my fundamental interests regarding sex. Only one surviving serious painting of this era even approached such subjects openly, not counting a short story in a book I wrote. And that picture was a minor offering, contaminated with sick violence at that. In fact, it seemed as though there was always plenty of violence in my civilized work, but never any real sex. Odd. As for therapy, I guess those new style paintings may have been therapeutic in other ways, but in terms of the kinds of poisonous energies which had to go into a painting like Beatty's Inferno, my work couldn't actually be said to have been affording me any therapy at all during those 20 years. Does that mean all those poisonous energies were simply absent for 20 years? No, it just means I was pretending they weren't there. And I guess poisonous is a relative term anyway. But I think some otherwise harmless energies and or impulses can become poisonous if they're denied an outlet, nor can they be studied and understood without one, hence the need for such therapeutic art. And at some point during that 20 years, I was lucky enough to lose that form of virginity that I alluded to a while back. Thus was my dream made flesh. Thus was my true sexual orientation finally fulfilled. Thus did my real sex life finally begin. And so forth, and so on, and yada, 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 etc., if you get my drift. It's not my purpose or intention to go into this matter very thoroughly here. I've written pretty extensively about it elsewhere, and that will have to stand. But a few general remarks may be in order at this time. First off, my proclivities probably aren't all that uncommon, even among heterosexuals. My obsession with anal sex may not be all that common, but I'm sure it isn't actually unique. nor do I think it should seem particularly disgusting on a relative scale. At least I'm only into consensual buggery. There are people out there whose thing it is to prey upon helpless children. There are people who get it on with animals. Christ, there are people who get their rocks off with shoes. And for my money, the child molesters make the relatively harmless shoe freaks look like veritable pillars of the community, if they don't happen to be such already. Moreover, all sexual interactions can be regarded as disgusting from some point of view, even simple procreation. Ask the passenger pigeons how they feel about human proliferation, if you can find any to ask. Better yet, ask your own not too distant descendants how they like living on a planet overpopulated to the point of sheer insanity. At least my perversion of choice doesn't contribute to that. Which all sounds a lot more defensive than it really is. I'm not ashamed of being what I am. To me, screwing women in the ass, or even letting them use some prosthetic method to screw me in the ass, seems normal, natural, and even beautiful. But if the rest of you see such practices as unspeakable, then I'd be a fool to flaunt them in your parochial, self-righteous faces, now wouldn't I? But it does allow me, interestingly, to combine my sense of beauty with my feeling for Pickmanesque loathsomeness and horror, if I'm not getting ahead of my story here. So I feel no shame about this, but I don't like being misunderstood about it either. I recall one woman who regarded me as a latent homosexual because of my interests. Well, I'm probably a latent axe murderer, too. What keeps me from being the one is a disinterest in other men's bodies, whereas my disinterest in violence keeps me from being the other. Unless my mind snaps and I go berserk or run amok or something, in which case all bets are off and you do well to get out of my way. At any rate, after my first real, quote, piece of ass, unquote, I was forced to regard anything less as mere foreplay. So I concentrated on finding partners who could share my preoccupations to some extent. I took to calling myself queer for women, and I thought I had it made for a while. Unfortunately, that snug and cozy little pleasure cruise capsized all too quickly with the societal specter of AIDS reared its ghastly head out of formerly friendly waters. Somehow, heterosexual sodomy dropped out of fashion. Easy come, easy go, I guess. Still, I like to think that I had my fun while the fun lasted. And somewhere in through there, I also took to collecting specialized hardcore porn that would help me keep the dream alive even during endless stretches of solitude. My form of autoeroticism was becoming increasingly fetishistic, if not downright paraphiliac, and my sex drive was becoming, if anything, greater than ever, in spite of, or perhaps because of, my isolation. So my dependence on pornography and other sexual paraphernalia was a case of needs must when the devil drives, if that is, I didn't want to be driven crazy by horniness as well as loneliness. Fortunately, my performance doppelganger, Goblinhood, also emerged during those years to shoulder the Pikmin-esque burden of it all. Being a form of weird paraphernalia himself, it's not surprising that sexual paraphilia would be right up his alley, as it were. Nobody at all familiar with my work should need an introduction to Goblinhood. Since 1990 or so, the vulgar buffoon in the spidery mask has taken center stage in all of my creative endeavors, from performances to paintings to cartoons to writings such as the present effort. And when he's not doing that, he's running around loose on the streets, annoying and disturbing people with his mask and calling that art. Beyond this and his occult and interdimensional Martian aspects and affiliations, Goblinhood functions primarily as an advocate for freedom of expression, the one political right without which an irritating work of art such as himself could never be able to exist. Naturally, that makes him a champion of the darker side of my work. Hence, as things developed, it seemed only natural that I would begin projecting my more berserk qualities, sexual and otherwise, onto this amiable Mr. Hyde figure who was himself a berserk quality. Happily, Goblinhood's so-called magic aura of Martian harmlessness kept all the weirder stuff from getting out of hand in ways that are virtually impossible to explain. So I'll have to ask you to just take my word for it. Before very long, the exhibitionistic Goblinhood was also the paraphiliac high priest of my lonely sex life, a sort of fetishistic hierophant. His very mask suggests some type of obscure bondage fun. But letting my more inhibited side blame it all on Goblinhood was only a stopgap measure at best. And Goblinhood's most serious and laudable quality, his devotion to freedom of expression, was slowly but surely planting seeds of destruction for my own routine practice of self-censorship.
Late in 1991, I attempted once again to pull out all the stops for a new painting. By this time, such network realism paintings as Millennium, 1989, were sneaking in some slightly more scurrilous material anyway. Network realism, a method of placing hundreds of miniature images into the same logically fragmented composition, was itself designed in part to allow such material in, first by making the stuff so obscure it would never be noticed, second by making it so small it could scarcely be seen. Even so, none of this stuff ever went very far. Unfortunately, the 1991 experiment didn't work out. It started as an intensely sexual and Pikmin-esque painting about Goblinhood called A Bugbear in Sodom, incorporating the lost Apocalypso paintings' berserk and centipede-like central image. And I really meant for this one to go over the top. I really did. But things didn't go as planned. part of the way into it, I got cold feet and tried to convert it into a civilized painting called, of all things, Temptation and Goblinhood. This meant that things like the bugbear monster would have to be toned down, I guess. But more importantly, all the remaining Sodom imagery was now supposedly to be left out, and so on. But this wouldn't do. The self-betrayal was a bit too raw this time, and the self-censorship a bit too much like business as usual. Nor did it help matters that I lacked anything really uplifting to portray in place of all that scunge. It was simply watered down, bowdlerized goblinhood lore and nothing more. Disgusted by my own lily-livered cop-out, and busy, it's true, with more immediate goblinhood work involving performance, I abandoned this painting for the next 5 years or so. Somewhere along the line, during that 5 years, I began trying to illustrate some poetry. Actually, just an obscure line or two of a long poem, with a long series of pencil and pen figure studies involving women taking it up the ass, usually seen sitting on it from behind, their luscious behinds nicely exposed. This wouldn't exactly do either, but instead of just blowing the experiment off, I wound up actually writing a novel of circa 260 pages, which tried to explain those drawings, or at least to give them something appropriate to illustrate. This so far unpublished novel, entitled Goblinhood Satyricon, wound up more or less codifying my current intricate approach to sex, among other things. It also remains my longest sustained bit of writing to date. And those now abandoned drawings, some of my best life drawing to date, had definitely touched a nerve. One day, a couple of years back, I found myself finishing up the latest goblinhood epic, an involved but restrained painting entitled Martian Gothic. I was wondering what to do next. It suddenly struck me that I'd run out of civilized stuff to say about goblinhood, let alone about anything else. But in goblinhood's case, those civilized things to say had never been more than the very tip of his iceberg. It occurred to me that this phase of my career must now be over.
"So you're all through making nice?"
snarled my Pikmin-esque persona from the back of my mind.
"So you mean we can finally get back to work now, at last?"
"Well, sure, guess so. Can't dance, and there's nothing else left to do." I celebrated the long interregnum's end by refurbishing a bugbear in Sodom with the kind of imagery originally intended for it, the kind of uncompromising imagery that had caused Goblinhood Satyricon to have to be written. A bugbear in Sodom started shaping up into a major painting, now nearly finished. One odd thing, however, though I never doubted the painting's importance in the overall scheme of what I'm trying to do, I quickly developed a serious, almost phobic, aversion to letting people see this painting, or even to letting them know of its existence. Go figure. But no, that's too easy to say, and it leads to exactly the kind of misinterpretation that I'd sooner avoid. I'm not ashamed of this work, at least not in the sense of doing something wrong, nor am I really ashamed of the work's self-revealing nature. Why should I be, when I can blame it all on goblinhood? No, it's simply the hassle of trying to explain this stuff that bothers me, especially the futile hassle of trying to somehow get my explanation past other people's closed minds. The words parochial and self-righteous might come into play here. And so I find myself, willy-nilly, inhabiting the kind of secret studio environment that I always envied Pikmin for. And I come, moreover, to the following rather alarming conclusion, that pure freedom of expression in the face of human prejudice and peer pressure can only exist in an atmosphere of utmost secrecy, an atmosphere ironically fatal to the free exchange of ideas that freedom of expression is meant to facilitate. Interesting paradox, n'est-ce pas? Good thing I'm not trying to convince anybody of anything with my current work. It only needs to get done. Whether it ever gets seen or not is a matter for the future to decide, probably after I'm already dead. And this essay, combined with what light Goblinhood Satyricon might someday shed on the subject, is the only explanation any of you are ever likely to get from me. At least this way, I can make my case, such as it is, without having to argue with all your stupid objections or listen to all your ignorant whims and whams, whether based on political correctness or on sheer fundamentalist religious bigotry. It's your hypocrisy that I can't stomach. You load your culture up with glorified violence, but you yelp when your children start shooting each other. But the violence has to stay, because it's part of what sells your fucking culture, whether straight or disguised as sports. The other part is sex, which your rapacious advertisers use to sell everything on the market, but only through clever innuendo, never even admitting that that's what it's all about. The real thing is this carefully guarded secret, and you'll never even know, much less admit, how sick all that dissembling is making you, how rotten, sick your whole lying culture has become. So fuck you. Don't show my work to children. It was never meant for that. And you're fucking their minds up enough as it is. Yeah, well, talk about self-righteous. This whole parenthetical diatribe is beginning to epitomize that concept, isn't it? And it's pretty funny, you've got to admit. A delirious ethical rant like this, whining and whimpering about your half-assed, moronic, tabloid trash culture in defense of the kind of artwork that I've been discussing here. I can hear Pikmin himself howling mirthfully from whatever nether hell he's ensconced in. So, okay, you're all as innocent as a newborn bunny rabbit in a brand new hutch, and I'm guilty as hell. No wonder I keep my light under a barrel these days. But at least I'm not doing all this to sell anything. Anyway, here's my rationale, that explanation I mentioned, submitted for your approval, for whatever it's worth, I suggest that you fold it until it's all corners, and then gently but firmly stick it up your big, fat, collective ass. That is, if you don't burn it, along with my work, and if you get the chance, along with me as well. Any questions? Meanwhile, even as a bugbear in Sodom was getting well underway, I knew that the real work was yet to come. I had yet to start so berserk a painting from scratch. Thus, I began planning my profane magnum opus, a literally a mock triptych entitled Sweet Sodom Apocalypso. I've had bad luck with triptychs before, but this time I hoped to avoid that by varying my approach. This time the massive triptych would consist of three totally separate paintings, uniform in size, that could also function together as a whole, in spite of their clear differences. Hard to say if it will actually work out that way. Most of my other triptychs started based on something like the same principle. The clearest difference here is the uniformity in size. That and the fact that I never did one using network realism before, let alone Martian pedimentation drawing. Both of those techniques are schemes for getting different kinds of information into the same statement, as is the triptych structure itself. The problem is to keep the whole thing from dissolving into a welter of schizophrenia, assuming that that isn't the whole point. But all this simply presents a challenging problem, which more or less is the point of the work. If it didn't challenge me, I wouldn't know that I was moving forward and making any progress. Besides, what good is an experiment if you already know how it will come out? Amusingly, and with subtle irony, the most disgusting panel, the most violent statement, would be entitled Temptation and Goblinhood. Remember that? The others would be The Spiders of Sodom, referring to something in the novel Goblinhood Satyricon. And finally, Ruby Tenure and the Warlock of Mars, the dark side of Martian Gothic, so to speak. Of late, the hands-on inception of this triptych, Sweet Sodom Apocalypso, has become quite imminent. I should be starting it in a couple of days. And on paper, it's already started and moving crisply along. And the triptych's eminence, too, is beyond question. Hell, Goblinhood is treating the project like a major religious festival of some obscure Martian variety, the 10th annual celebration of harmlessness, he calls it. And in truth, this should be the most profound philosophical, socio-political, spiritual, psycho-sexual, and downright psychiatric statement that I've ever attempted, meant both as personal and as global psychotherapy. Whether it can be accepted as such by the public is irrelevant to me. Hell, they probably laughed at Caligula too, though probably not for long. For all its vulgar self-indulgences and deliberate vilenesses, then, for all its odious excesses and monstrosities of approach, Sweet Sodom Apocalypso is also somehow meant as a proud capstone to my painting career, even if I don't want anybody to know about it. A great and guilty triumph. And it was, thus, on the very eve of the triptych, that I had a possibly prophetic little dream, a dream in which sweet Sodom Apocalypso was already underway in the form of three unspeakable paintings slouching toward some obscure Bethlehem of the mind, next to which a bugbear in Sodom was only a mere pale harbinger of underground and Pickmanesque concepts to come. And if the following dream narrative seems anticlimactic to you, consider what it must have been like for me, having to write all this in an effort to make some kind of sense of it. And if that effort has been unsuccessful, console yourselves with the thought that you now know a lot more about my work than you were ever supposed to, if that's any consolation. 4. And so finally we get to the dream that I call Steel Bob and Monstrella. The title alone is vaguely suggestive, but what the action of the dream suggests is unclear. Monstrella is called Monstrella here because her appearance, though not the way she looks, is so galvanizing and chaotic, like Godzilla hitting Tokyo on a 3-day pass. Steel Bob was called Steel Bob in the dream itself, and represents I know not exactly what. The entire dream took place in an upstairs apartment. Somehow it seemed way upstairs, 20 stories or so. I'd never seen this place before, but I liked it at once. It had a really spiffy studio, a sort of screened-off balcony with a skylight. This studio also somehow contained a secret chamber that nobody but me was supposed to know about, though it was wide open and in plain sight. A sort of large, open, secret closet space in some indeterminate part of the room. Things started out pretty copacetic. In the studio, the newly started, long-awaited, sweet Sodom Apocalypso triptych was finally underway. It sat there with its vulgar face hanging out, like an aroused mongrel dog, wagging its tail almost obscenely. Its form was that of 3 30-by-40-inch stretched canvases, easily stacked and hidden, covered at this point with Martian underdrawing in the form of lurid colored pencil sketches, incredibly colored.